This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Melina Kibbe is a national figure in the fight for sex equality in research. She's a vascular surgeon and chair of the UNC School of Medicine's Department of Surgery. When she took up that position, she became a member of an exclusive club. Only about 10% of surgery chairs in the country are women. And a big part of her mission is also to make sure that women are represented in the surgical research itself. Drugs and therapies are mostly tested on male animals and male cells, and the effects can be harmful and even deadly for women who are prescribed those treatments. Dr. Kibbe is a member of the National Academy of Medicine and editor-in-chief of the journal JAMA Surgery, and she is with me now on the State of Things. Melina Kibbe, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
I want to talk all about your research and a lot about this disparity in research, but I take us back now to your earliest days. You grew up in Southern California, right?
I did. I was born in La Jolla, which just outside of San Diego, but really grew up in a suburb of Southern California.
What was that like for you, and what were your aspirations of it? Because this would be the 1970s, 80s, 1980s.
Yes, yeah. So 70s and 80s. And I would say I absolutely loved growing up in Southern California, especially as I became a junior high school and high school student. And that was in the 80s.
Were you a Valley girl?
Yeah, I was just going to say I was definitely a Valley girl. And if you had met me back then, my speech would be very different. I had a very thick Valley girl accent.
Oh, I wish you could do it. Maybe later. We'll get you, once you warm up, we'll get you to do that. The Moon Unit. Remember the Moon Unit Zappa song?
Oh, of course.
Yeah. Was that offensive to you at the time? Just cool. You were the youngest of three, and your dad a retired nuclear engineer, right?
Yes.
Would you now? And I know that this was difficult for you because at that point, early in the family's life, at least when you were, as you say, the youngest of three, your parents went through a heated and difficult divorce, right?
Yeah, they did. So I was 5 years old. So again, the youngest is three, as you mentioned, but they got divorced when I was five. And my father, about a year and a half later, moved away from Southern California to Tennessee for his career. So he worked for Oak Ridge National Laboratory in Knoxville, and he's still in Knoxville to this day.
And you tell some fascinating stories that feel traumatic to me, although they're peppered with humor, on how your parents, because it was a difficult divorce. It was a contentious divorce. You talk about these kind of mutual kidnappings that were your growing up.
Yeah. So I look back at my childhood and I reflect on my childhood and about the divorce because I'm asked often if I think that the divorce had an impact on me as a person and my career. I think I was too young for it to have that kind of an impact, but I don't know. So I can tell you this. Boy, my parents... The issue was that they got the divorce, and this was in the 70s. And in California, my mother was granted sole custody of all three of us children. The challenging part was that both of my parents really loved us, and both of my parents wanted us. And so that then set up what became, almost comical, and you could write a movie on it. I remember... one summer, so growing up, the deal was we were allowed to spend summers with my father in Tennessee and then come back for the school year in California. Well, one summer between my first grade and second grade, for some reason, my dad decided to not return us. And next thing I know, because remember, I'm a little kid, next thing I know is my dad's enrolling me in second grade in Knoxville, Tennessee. So I start making some new friends, and one day, a couple months in to second grade, I was at the dentist office, and I just remember all this hysteria going on. What had happened is my mom, with a friend, had flown to Tennessee and kidnapped my brother and sister out of the hands of the babysitter. And the only reason she wasn't able to get me is because I was at the dentist office. So then I have memories of, I was in the sole kid in Tennessee with my dad, and he kind of my dad and my stepmom made a little game of it where if a car drove by and we were in the kitchen eating, I would duck. It was a game. And I know you look at this now and you're like, what? And then about a couple weeks after that, mysteriously, my dad goes on a business trip and comes back with my brother. So he flew to California and kidnapped my brother while he was on the street riding his bike and brought my brother back to Tennessee.
All right, so what are the authorities making you
Yeah, at
this?
That point, after the kidnappings back and forth, and also it started, I guess, with my dad keeping us, the courts put a stop to it. And the courts apparently told both of my parents if there was any more kidnapping, they would both go to jail.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have a memory of while the courts were trying to sort this out, and I was still in Tennessee, that in order to see my mom, I remember being at a park and she had to be escorted with a uniformed police officer. So I have these memories. I don't think that it had an impact on me, but I don't know. Maybe it did. I don't know.
Well, we can talk about that throughout the program, too, and as we unfold your career and what you're doing now. But in the moment, what is your memory of what you were feeling when all this was happening?
Well, I was so young, and I think my dad did a good job, like I said, of making a game out of some of it. I don't think I really understood the full context. And even to this day, I haven't really talked to either one of my parents about it. It's still very raw, and they still do not get along. There were, even a few years later, there were still scenes like out of, you know, Dynasty, if you remember that show. I know you do. But I remember my stepmother showing up on my mom's doorstep and my mom slapping her and like just drama. And it all stemmed from the fact that, again, both parents really loved us and wanted us. And so I do keep that in my mind.
And how did you feel about them?
Oh, I love both my parents. Unfortunately, after that whole incident with my dad keeping us and all of that, I really didn't get to see much of my dad after that for the rest of my childhood. And so I didn't really get to know my father growing up. And it was only when I left California and went to college is when I started my relationship with my father.
That's interesting because he's the scientist in the family, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which is what you became. Your mom, a businesswoman. She owned a 7-Eleven.
Yeah, I also do give my mom a lot of credit. She's a hardworking woman. She owned a 7-Eleven store. And I do credit my mom for my work ethic in the sense that, and this is another amazing thing when I look back on it, I started working when I was in second grade, after coming back, basically, from all of that. My mom instilled in me, she wanted to make sure I really had a sense for what a dollar meant. And I had to earn things that I wanted outside of the typical allowance, etc. So I started working at the 7-Eleven store and doing things as a second grader. I was sweeping the parking lot. That was the first job I remember having.
And also stocking the candy bins.
Yes.
Not a bad gig.
Yeah, so I escalated up in the duties, and I have to say, I don't think it was very smart that my mom had a little child stocking the candy bins.
Well, maybe she did know. Maybe you were underpaid, and you didn't even think about it because you had this little perk, this little benefit. And some. You also were a sci-fi geek, right?
Yeah.
At the same time?
Yeah, big time. I would say my nerdiness evolved as I grew up because I don't know why I'm such a sci-fi nerd because I remember watching when my brother, we'd fight over the TV and my older brother would always be watching Star Trek, the original. And I used to be annoyed by it because I wanted to watch my little girl cartoons. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know if it instilled something in me. I don't know. But later in high school and especially in college, I became a big sci-fi nerd.
What were your favorites?
Oh, I watched every episode of Star Trek Next Generation.
Yeah.
Oh, and pretty much anything with the word star in it. Well, and of course, Star Wars came out when I was a kid as well. But I would say literally anything with the word star in it, Star Wars, Star Trek, Stargate 1, Battlestar Galactica, you name it.
Now, there's a degree of gizmology and sci-fi-ness in there, the science fiction and future worlds. But also, and I suppose this is true with most good storytelling, it's about the characters and about the relationships. What do you think it is in that grabbed you?
I think for me, it's the escapism. Mm. So, you know, there's people who like to read. Oh my gosh, my mom was one of those. She would just, I'd catch her reading all the time. It'd be one of those things where to try to get her attention, we would do things to get her attention away from the book. I have never been a reader. I've been a TV and movie watcher, and that's my escapism.
Escaping into the chair of the Department of Surgery at UNC School of Medicine and the editor-in-chief of the journal JAMA Surgery, Melina Kibbe, is my guest this hour. And we will find out how surgery in her own, when she went under the knife herself, turned her attention to her current profession. We'll talk about that and her mission. We'll talk about all that on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay tuned. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio talking to Melina Kibbe, who is a leader in the fight against sex bias in research. She's the chair of the Department of Surgery at UNC School of Medicine and the first woman to hold that position. Her research is centered on developing new vascular therapies. She's also on a mission to bring gender equity to drug testing, and we're figuring out how you got there. Before the break, we were talking about your childhood in California and Tennessee, and one of the most significant events that happened to you happened when you were a teen, and you were diagnosed with scoliosis. Tell us about that.
Correct. So it was a freshman year of high school when they screen all the kids, and, you know, they have you, you know, kind of lean over so they could see if you have the curvature, and I had a freakishly severe curvature that was diagnosed. And before I knew it, I was seeing a surgeon and had surgery.
Had you any idea? I mean, had this bothered you or had anyone else noticed?
No clue. No clue. But mine was so bad that actually my whole rib cage had turned. Mm. So if I just leaned over, you would have seen I looked like a humpback. And so my whole spinal cage and rib cage had turned. And I had an S-shaped curve.
Now, obviously, this because it had to be diagnosed in this particular test or this screening, it hadn't affected you yet. Right? What would have happened had they not diagnosed? What's the course of this?
That's a good question. I don't know. I haven't actually thought about what would happen if my curvature continued to progress. I think at some point I probably would have had pain.
Yeah, because you're talking about not just a curvature, but everything being way out of alignment. So what do they do?
Oh, so he put in, so I had an orthopedic surgeon who put a Harrington rod into my back. And it's a long stainless steel metal rod that's attached to just below my neck and goes all the way down to about my waist. And basically they use that to straighten the spine.
Well, what kind of I really want to picture this because I know how the spine works. We've got this bundle of nerves that go down the middle of it. Where do you put it? You attach it to the outside?
Yeah, exactly. So they attach it to the outside of the bone. Now, things have changed since I had my surgery in the early 80s. But when they did mine, they attached the metal to the bone up top and then they attached it down at the bottom as well.
You're a freshman in high school. You're not at your full growth yet. What do they do about that?
They also, believe it or not, they kind of use bone cement. So from the bone that they clip, they then do bone cement and then fuse part of my spinal column together.
So they keep that from wrecking their good work.
Yeah, there you go.
But they have to do that. What about, so was this scary for you to get this diagnosis and then hear that that's what's going to happen?
You know, I don't have any memories of being scared. I just remember thinking, great, I was going to get a lot of ice cream in the hospital.
Wow. They just downplayed the whole metal rod in your back part of that, huh?
Yeah.
What was that like? But you developed a relationship with this surgeon that transformed your life.
Yeah. So I would say that it was, when people ask me, why am I a surgeon? I can very clearly say it's because of this incident. I thought the world of this surgeon, and I wanted to be just like him, and I wanted to do what he did. I wanted to be able to fix people.
And it worked. I mean, that's the other thing, is that you came out of this, and it worked. And going into it, he also placed you with others who were about to have the surgery, so you became a kind of a support group, right?
Yeah. So after my surgery, I told him that I was really interested in what he did. So he then allowed me to counsel other girls who were about to have the surgery about what the experience was like. And that just solidified that I wanted to go in and be a surgeon and go into medicine. Nobody from my family was in medicine.
What about that role for you, all of a sudden having to be some kind of an expert? I mean, obviously your experience qualifies you, but how did you feel about that?
Oh,
role?
I loved it. Yeah? It was fun. I loved it.
You were ready to go. Now, maybe a downside was the fact that you ended up having to wear this big plastic brace for a while. How long
were
you?
Huge downside. So at the time, back in, this was again 82, after surgery, I had to wear a plastic brace that went all the way around my body, and it was basically from my shoulders down to my hip. I became a quiet, very reserved, self-conscious girl for the 6 months I had to wear this. Because I imagine being a freshman in high school and you have to wear this. I thought everyone could see it. I would even have people who would come up to me and knock on my back. I was horrible, horrible as a little freshman in high school to go through this.
Yeah. Well, so, but it was 6 months. Did you even notice that you had become transferred? This was affecting your personality?
Yes, I did. Mm. I was very aware that I became shy. Very aware.
For 6 months, then the brace comes off. How long did it take you to shed that new personality?
I would say that, yeah, over the next year and a half, I really came into my own and really opened up and became a pretty independent person.
Now, that independence led to a form of mild to medium rebellion, would you say?
Well, okay, I was a straight-A kid. I'm just going to point this out. Uh-huh. I was a straight-A kid, and I, because of that, I had my trust of my mother. And, being in Southern California as a junior and senior in high school, I will say that I did have a lot of fun on the weekends.
Okay. The brace comes off, and out you go. But you're also still determined to become a surgeon.
Yes.
And you decide to go to the University of Chicago?
Yes.
I mean, because you were in Southern California, you had a lot of other options as well. Not that that's not a good school, but what made you decide to go 2,000 miles away?
You remind me of some of my high school teachers, by the way.
Okay.
Many of whom said the same thing and said, Melina, why would you leave Southern California? What is wrong with you? You know, and I have to say, when you live in California, people have a hard time thinking that there's any better place to live.
Mm-hmm.
Very little narrow-minded there. But I also did something that nobody would do in today's day and age. So, you know, when you're a junior and senior in high school and they start sending you, all the different colleges start sending you information. Well, University of Chicago was very persistent. I kept getting stuff in the mail. I knew nothing about University of Chicago. So one day I finally went to the Career Center and I looked them up and I read about them and I was pretty impressed. And there was another impressive event where at Christmas time during the holidays, they had a reception in Beverly Hills at a doctor's house on Rodeo Drive. I am not kidding you. And the dean and everybody and students were there. And this is where I'm going to tell you, I started to celebrate my nerdiness. I loved the stories that the college students were telling me. About what a nerdy school it was and how much fun it was to be a nerd. And I literally signed up to go to University of Chicago, sight unseen. I never visited the campus.
Well, maybe a lot of people do that, and it would be wise to have the Christmas party on Rodeo Drive and not, you know, in Chicago and Christmas. Because then you would have realized this is not a good place to be in the winter.
Yeah, and Hyde Park is beautiful, yeah, but not in the best neighborhood.
So you went, but you did go. What was it like for you?
So it was the best experience ever, and I would go to University of Chicago all over again. I do have to say, you know, it's no secret that Chicago is experiencing its crime right now. However, this was 1986, and I remember driving my little car cross country. And I'm driving into the city for the first time ever. I'm going down Lakeshore Drive to go to campus. No joke, there is a dead body on the median of Lakeshore Drive. That was my welcome to Chicago.
But you stayed. What made you decide? So surgery, you were determined since you were a freshman to become a surgeon. But vascular surgery, what made you decide that?
Another pivotal event, believe it or not. So I was a first-year medical student. And this is back when we have mostly all big lectures in lecture halls. And there was a lecture that was given on atherosclerosis, which is plaque buildup in the arteries. And the person who gave the lecture is this very well-known pathologist, but the way he presented the theory of how plaque develops in the artery was just fascinating. And then the last half of the lecture was a vascular surgeon, Bruce Gewirtz, who came in and showed a video of one of the common procedures that vascular surgeons do. It's called a carotid endarterectomy. And that's basically where the surgeon, we go in and we peel out the plaque that's in the carotid artery in the neck to prevent strokes from occurring, because the plaque can break off and go to the brain. And watching this video of dissecting out the artery, clamping it, opening it up, peeling the plaque out and sewing it shut, even now I get goosebumps. It is just amazing. And that is why I'm a vascular surgeon to this day.
That is probably the most incredible testimony I've ever heard, because what you just described would cause me never to become a vascular surgeon or go into that lecture hall ever again. But there you have it, and that's the difference, one of the many differences. Melina Kibbe is the chair of the UNC School of Medicine's Department of Surgery. She's a vascular surgeon and many other things, as we will determine. You really are a geek. Tear open somebody's artery, rip out the plaque, and you're going, that's for me. So, and you did. And this is something interesting, too, because in many cases, particularly in medicine and law, other professions, you know, students have figured this out either many years ahead of time or maybe throughout the process, you know, make their decision after a long kind of incubation and deliberation. But you have these pivotal moments, these epiphanies, and that was one of them for you.
Yeah. And I always ask myself why, because this definitely, my path is not the norm. Like you just pointed out, most medical students figure out what profession they want to pursue in their third year of medical school when they're rotating on all the different specialties. So I don't know why for me, I had these two very pivotal events that shaped my whole life.
Now, what's it like for you as a med student who's going to specialize in surgery in those times? We talked about the fact that you're only a member of, you know, there are only 10% of you now, women, who are chairs of surgery departments. And this is 2018. We're talking about the mid-80s. Was sexism something that you encountered?
So I would say that I have experienced my share, but the women who came before me, so I would say the women that were 10 and 20 years older than me, clearly paved the way. And they were the ones that experienced, I think, the bulk of sexism and harassment. When I went to medical school, and again, this was, we were not yet at 50-50 for male-female enrollment, but I had a really good experience. The sexism that I experienced was really so open and overt that when it would occur, it would just make me laugh because it was so over the top. The stuff that would upset me is the subtle subconscious bias. That's the stuff that upsets me.
Well, give us some examples. I mean, what was the overt stuff that you just had to laugh off?
Well, one of them was, as a medical student, I was in the operating room. And I was, you know, after the patient's asleep and you have to put the catheter into the bladder to drain the bladder during the surgery. And so you have to insert it, you know, and this is a male patient. So you have to insert it, you know, through the penis. And I was basically preparing the patient and using the Betadine to clean and prep the area. So as I'm holding the penis, literally, the older white male gray-haired surgeon who at the time was wearing cowboy boots walks in. I'm just painting the picture. Walks in and literally says, "Grab it like you want it, honey." And I mean, come on. How can you do anything but almost laugh at that? It's so over the top.
Well, but so it there is a certain comic effect that that has. But underneath all of that, there is this the hint that maybe you're not going to get as far as the guys.
Yeah, correct. Correct. So and it's easier to deal with, again, the overt bias like that. It's harder to deal with the subconscious bias.
What do you mean?
Well, I think that for women, you know, women do have to prove themselves a little bit more to be noticed. Another incident is there was another medical student who wanted to go into surgery in my year. And it really came down to, you know, him and I were the two most, you know, eager and interested in surgery. But he was, you know, the bow tie wearing male who, of course, got, you know, invited, you know, to hang out with the surgeons, could go into the locker room, etc. I was the female. And I remember really trying to prove myself to many of the surgeons there. This was at University of Chicago still. And then one day when I was interviewing, and this was interviewing for residency positions, one of the surgeons that I was trying to prove myself really hard to had my CV, my curriculum vitae, in front of him and literally said to me, "Melina, wow, you're very accomplished. Had I known..." You know, so that was a really important moment for me because, you know, it really showed the subconscious bias.
Right. The mind was already made up.
Exactly.
And I hadn't even bothered to look. So, but you were able to transcend this. You could take some of it with a dose of humor. Your CV was so superior to others that here you are today. But it had to have a chilling effect on other women and a power and you know, and it's not funny to a lot of women who understand what this means and why they said that and why they're trying to shut me out. Would you say that a lot of women sort of left the profession or were chased out or scared away because of this culture that you had to endure?
Oh, yes, still to this day. And that is something that I'm very passionate about. I try to make sure that I communicate to women and men, you know, that don't let anyone tell you what you can and you can't do. And just last week, I was with a group of medical students, and I do this every time. I asked for a show of hands how many of the women have been told they shouldn't go into surgery for a variety of reasons. Literally 90% of the hands went up. This was last week. So it upsets me because then when you ask, well, who are telling these female students not to pursue a career in surgery? And, you know, a lot are uninformed and don't really understand. It's an amazing career. You can have a partner in life. You can have children. It's just all about the choices that you make. And you can have an amazing career.
Well, and again, whether or not men are told the same thing for the same reasons is, you know, the other show of hands. And, of course, that's part of the way the bias builds in underrepresentation, which takes us to underrepresentation in research. You ended up latching on to a mentor in med school, Dr. Monica Morrow, who is influential. Tell us about her.
Yeah, I was really fortunate. She was great. And again, I, you know, aspire to provide the kind of mentorship that others have provided for me because I've had amazing mentorship. Well, I remember, so Monica Morrow is a very well-known breast surgeon. She's at Memorial Sloan Kettering right now. But I latched on to her as a medical student. And when it came time for me to show her the list of residency programs I was thinking of applying to, she took my list with a red pen and started going down the list. Great program, really good, strong program, sexist chair, you're not going there. Great program, great. And she went down the list, and I was just like, wow, it was amazing.
But this talks about the trailblazers, right? The people
yes.
who had to experience all this first and one way or another get through it.
Who she
can
is
then
one
be
of
a guide,
them.
Right?
Yes.
And also a kind of hierarchy of sexism, right? I mean, if I asked her to go through that list, she would probably not tell me that any one of them was a culture free of this sort of thing. But avoid this one because you're not getting anywhere with this person. So what did you do from that? What choices did you make? You ended up going to Northwestern, right?
I went to University of Pittsburgh for my residency. If you would have asked me back then, a Southern California girl who then went to Chicago, if she was going to be in Pittsburgh, yeah, I would not have predicted it. But Pittsburgh was one of those programs where when I had my interview day, the stars aligned. And I just was so welcomed there. And there were all these people had connections to University of Chicago and California. And I ended up ranking them number one and I matched there. And again, I have no regrets. I'd do it all over again.
And then you started your career actually at Northwestern.
So after I finished my general surgery residency training at Pittsburgh, I then did a 1 year vascular fellowship at Northwestern. And then, yes, I stayed on and took my first job at Northwestern. And I was there for my entire career until 2 years ago.
We'll talk about that and what happened in the 2 years that followed when my conversation with Melina Kibbe continues on the state of things. She is chair of the Department of Surgery at UNC School of Medicine and the editor-in-chief of the journal JAMA Surgery. Our conversation continues on the state of things in just a few moments. Please stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Melina Kibbe's with me, chair of the Department of Surgery at UNC School of Medicine, the first woman to hold that position at UNC. Also a leader in the fight against sex bias in research, which is something that you came to understand when you went to Northwestern, right? And didn't bring that knowledge with you. You discovered it when you got there.
Yeah, I would say that, I'm both a surgeon and a scientist, and in my lab, I'm trying to develop better therapies for patients with vascular disease, and I've been doing this for many years. How this came about is actually through ignorance on my own part. I'm going to be honest. I had been developing my therapies and studying my therapies in male cells and male animals because I was taught to do that. Because as a scientist, you control for all variables in your experiments. So you control for the variable of sex. Well, literally one day, Teresa Woodruff, she's the director for the Institute of Women's Health Research there, we were talking. And she was asking me about my research and how it was going. And I told her it was going great. And she asked me, well, Melina, how does it work in both males and females? And she kind of stopped me dead in my tracks with that question. And I said, well, I haven't studied it in females. And so she then really kind of gave it to me and educated me about how important it was. And she was absolutely right. And not only did she educate me about how important it is to make sure I study my therapy in both sexes, she then gave me money, a little research grant to do this. So I went back to the lab, and the therapy that I had been working on for almost a decade, I then went and tested it in the female rats, only to find that it didn't work at all. And I had to increase the dose tremendously higher and for me to see the same efficacy in the females as the males. So that was my light bulb moment, because I had been spending my entire career developing this therapy, and I never even had the forethought to ask, does it work equally in both sexes?
Well, it's interesting to me. I mean, again, you can blame yourself, but this was the way of doing things. This is not anything that you dreamed up all by yourself. And it does seem puzzling to me if the worry is that introducing a second gender would create a variable. In other words, I would question it. Oh, sure, it works in men, but what about women? Or well, it seems to me that if that's a variable, but that would trigger the question, shouldn't we be testing it in female minds?
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
Not for
you should
you,
work
but,
for the NIH.
Well, I'm just saying it's not your fault, but how is it that it didn't occur to anybody that this is a variable we should actually test?
Yeah, it's amazing because, again, so to do that, it in defense of all of the investigators and myself, so it does take more animal lives, obviously, and it takes more money and more time. There's also investigators, you know, who have concerns that, you know, the female animals with the cycle could introduce other variables into the experiments. But really, none of those are valid
reasons. Because
that's
the variable that you're going to have ultimately.
Correct.
That will be your market. And this is not just in the therapy that you were testing, this light bulb moment for you. I mean, nationally, it became a very big story with regard to Ambien, right?
Yeah. So Ambien is what really allowed those of us who were advocating for this topic, it allowed us to finally get traction at a national level. So what happened is Ambien is a sleep-inducing medication. It's been on the market for a long time. And several years ago, there were reports of women the next day after taking it, getting behind the wheel of an automobile and having accidents. So when they studied this, because they were getting more and more reports of this happening, they realized that women metabolize the drug more slowly than men. So for the first time ever, the FDA issued a label change. And now for Ambien, women are recommended to take half the dose that men recommend.
And this is instructive because in your test for the therapy you were working on, women weren't getting enough once you tested. And in the case of Ambien, they're getting too much, which is to say this is an entirely different system that we're working on. We need to test. So how are things today?
Well, that just happened a few years ago. And so with Ambien, I'll tell you that there were several of us under Teresa's leadership at Northwestern and many others across the country who were really trying to impact change on this topic and to get more people to investigate therapies in both sexes. And we were really lucky because we wrote away to a whole bunch of news agencies. And lo and behold, Leslie Stahl actually thought the topic was interesting. And so they did a story in 60 Minutes. And it goes to show what your profession can do for an issue is that once the story aired on 60 Minutes, oh my gosh, things finally started happening. And most important, the NIH, the National Institutes of Health, which is our largest funder of research, they, within months of that story airing, basically stated that they were going to develop a policy that was going to require investigators to balance the use of cells, male and female cells in animals in their research. And they did. It took about a year and a half, but the policy came out. And so now, for all investigators who are submitting grants to the NIH, they have to include sex as a variable in their grant application.
It's interesting, too, that when you're talking about animals for the most part, but then when it comes to human trials, we've seen this with regard to race as well, underrepresentation, African-American communities for a variety of reasons. And then if you also think about some of the other conditions, I mean, there used to be a joke about the fact that medicines work very well on white male grad students because they're the ones who get most of the testing. You know, people in different socioeconomic conditions that have different health outcomes, you can almost imagine how, and in some ways, deficient our testing might be if we start opening up the question.
Oh, I agree completely. If you want that gotcha moment on the 60 Minutes story, it's, by the way, you can listen to it. But exactly, you have to ask, if this happened with Ambien, how many other drugs out there have different efficacy based on the sexes, based on race, ethnicity, age, weight? They're all important. But if we can't get the basic variable of sex down, how are we ever going to achieve personalized medicine?
Well, and if you're only asking about efficacy, you might be missing a whole other raft of questions about, you know, ways in which it's interacting with other medicines, ways in which it's interacting with your own immune system. So there are lots of questions to ask. Representation would be the key to at least getting some of this. You were in that 60 Minutes program.
I was
part of that. So this makes you a kind of a spokesperson and gives you a national profile. Are you comfortable with that?
Well, this is my first time ever advocating for an issue. And I have to say, it's been an amazing experience seeing, again, what your profession can do when you get that kind of a national platform for a topic. But yeah, it's important. I'm also, you know, very passionate about this topic. And if we can impact change, then we will improve human health.
What about representation in departments of medicine? As we said a couple of times now, you're one of only 10% of the population of women who chair surgery departments at medical schools. What is the culture? Is it changing? Is there enough awareness about the culture at medical school to be more inviting for women?
Yeah, so I think it is improving. I have to tell you, my experience at UNC has been amazing, very welcoming. So when you say 10%, I'm one of, today, 21 female chairs of departments of surgery in the country. Now, I got to tell you, just a few years ago, there were only 8. So we have seen a tremendous growth from 8 to 21 just over a matter of 3 years. And I believe that that is through increasing awareness of this issue. Now, have I experienced some unique challenges as a female leader in a male-dominated area? I would say yeah.
Yeah, like what?
Well, I would just say that I've really appreciated that, again, when you put a woman in a position of leadership in a mostly male-dominated field, that it's made me aware that women do have unique needs and unique challenges that sometimes are best addressed by a female leader.
As in?
Well, I think I'm going to leave it at that.
But what does it mean? I mean, so we have to acknowledge there's a difference, right? And this becomes the challenge when we talk about diversity and diversifying our workplace, because it's usually under the theory that we're all alike. And then this then obviates the difference. This obliterates the difference and then makes it challenging to try to meet those differences in a unique way.
Yeah. And for me, it's really important that we are creating a work environment that is an educational work environment, because we have a lot of trainees. We've got medical students, we've got residents, we've got fellows that we're training, as well as the faculty. Everybody deserves to work in an environment that is free of any kind of bias or harassment of any kind.
But you almost didn't take this job, right?
So I didn't apply to this job. That's the funny part. Again, if you would have asked me when I was in Chicago, a city girl, I've lived in cities all my life, if I was going to move to Chapel Hill, I would have said, are you crazy? What planet are you from? So I actually did not apply when this job became available. And I'll tell you why I didn't apply, because I actually did look at the prior four chairs of this Department of Surgery. And they were all older, white, male clinical surgeons. And I felt they were nothing like me. And I'm, you know, a surgeon scientist, female, etc. So I did not submit my name. And then one day, one of the search committee members tracked me down in Chicago. And I had three offices. And I was in this one office that nobody knew the phone number. She calls my office. And this is actually at the VA. And asked me if I would apply for this position. And I said, thank you for the call. Actually, no, I'm not interested, but here are some names of my friends. And then she was so persistent, and she did such a great job convincing me that leadership was interested in my candidacy and what I would bring to this position, knowing that I looked very different from the prior four chairs.
Has it meant anything to the people who are, to women now in your department? Are they coming to you telling you things that maybe they wouldn't be telling men?
I think so. I do think so, yes.
What are you hearing?
Well, again, it gets back to making sure that we're creating an environment that is 100% educational and free of bias for all.
And people are experiencing that.
I will just say that again, you know, there are some unique needs that women and men have. And I think it's important that we listen to all concerns that are brought forward.
Talk about your research. It's fascinating stuff. And I think you can even explain it to us in a way that we can understand.
Okay. So I'm a vascular surgeon. So I tend to, for patients, I tend to say I'm like a glorified plumber. And oh, heck, my husband refers to me as a plumber as well. So, but what I do is when plaque builds up in arteries, that's what clogs the arteries. One of the common procedures that we do is to balloon open your artery. So you probably heard about it with the coronaries in your heart, you know, having angioplasty done where you balloon open the arteries of your heart. Well, one of the problems is that that procedure does not last very long. So it's not that durable. And over the years, people have put in stents to try to, you know, help keep the arteries open longer. Same thing, they have challenges. So what I'm trying to do is to develop better therapies that will help to treat that plaque and keep the arteries open longer so that you don't need to be seeing surgeons and you can stay out of the hospital.
And some of that is chemical, right? This is what you're discovering.
Yeah. So I have what I, one of my, many of my favorite projects, but one of them I actually do call my Star Trek project. It's we're trying to develop a smart technology. So it's a nanotherapeutic, so nano-sized drug. And the vision is this: that we can inject it into an IV, okay, just a standard IV that a patient might have. And this therapy would be smart. So it would circulate in your bloodstream, but then hone to the site where you had the procedure done, like the balloon, and then bind to the artery at that site and then release a drug that will basically restore the artery to a healthy state.
Because part of the problem was that the treatment itself created a kind of scar tissue owing to a lack of or lower production of
nitric oxide.
Nitric
You're good.
With a C. Yeah.
So that's one of my goals is exactly that mechanical force of blowing open that balloon is actually trauma to the artery. So while it's meant to open up the artery, it initiates this cascade of events where the cells in the wall of the artery start to grow out of control and grow into the inside and re-clog the artery. So if we deliver nitric oxide to that site, the nitric oxide prevents all those cells from growing out of control.
There you go. So you're repairing the damage done by the therapy. But, of course, that was an intervention that may have saved your life. And it's not laughing gas we're talking about.
No.
It's a completely different chemical. So I don't have too much time for this, but you have a husband. When you thought about surgery, and I think that one of the reasons people get warned off this profession at all is because this is the one that is the most, in many ways, so demanding and doesn't allows for less personal time. Was that something you considered, and how has that affected you?
No, you know, when I decided I wanted to be a surgeon, I didn't think of any of those things because I just knew it was right for me and I was passionate about it. I will say that I met my husband later in life. I did have relationships, long-term relationships before, and actually dated somebody in your business who was a TV producer for a little while. But I met Marco, and we just got married 5 years ago.
You had some fairly interesting online dating experiences.
Oh, my gosh. I feel like I could write a book off of that.
You only have time for one of them, unfortunately, because it's right at the end of the show. But the fact is you were a little bit reluctant to put in the fact that you were a doctor, you know, right away. And then you did, and your worries were actually confirmed.
Oh, yes. There were some men who wanted a sugar mama. I'm going to leave it at that.
And sent you like the Fabio pictures, right? They got the whole thing?
And then, yes.
And then what? Fly me to the United States and I'll show you a good time.
Yeah, a guy from Paris wanted me to fly him here. Yes, yes.
Great stuff. Okay.
Unbelievable.
We'll have you back and we'll tell nothing but those stories. Melina Kibbe is a vascular surgeon. She is the chair of the UNC School of Medicine's Department of Surgery, a member of the National Academy of Medicine, and the editor-in-chief of the journal JAMA Surgery. So I'm glad we spent more time talking about that than those other things. Great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Our program is produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, and Amanda Magnus. Robin Copley is our technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.